on radio station KTOO. This is Reality Sandwich, and today the program will be interviewing Fletcher Prouty. Hello, Fletcher. Are you there?
Good evening, Paul. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you. Wanted to talk to you about some of the things, the Bay of Pigs and Vietnam, and how they relate to the Kennedy history and the Kennedy assassination.
Well, you know, that's a good outline, and unusually good, because, you know, terrible things happen when a man dies in the middle of history because his enemies or others choose to distort the things that he did. And one of the greatest distortions in the period of time you mentioned is the Bay of Pigs program itself. And we ought to spend a few minutes on that, because the people's, the general idea of what Kennedy did or did not do at the Bay of Pigs has been extremely distorted from the time it happened.
Uh-huh. Well, okay. Yeah, if you could give us some summary of how you see the relationship of the Bay of Pigs to the Kennedy assassination, and I'd appreciate it, and our listeners would also.
Well, let me begin with one
thing. Oh, wait a minute. Let me give you a proper introduction. Or maybe you could just outline your involvement in this period so that our listeners would know your credentials, basically.
Fine. Well, the Bay of Pigs occurred, as you recall, in 1961. In 1961, I was working for the Secretary of Defense, at that time, Mr. Gates. And in the period in 61, I was working for Mr. McNamara at the Office of Secretary of Defense level. I had been in the Pentagon at that time since 1955, and I was the Chief of Special Operations. Now, in military terms, special operations means providing the military support for the clandestine operations of the CIA. So I was working very closely with the CIA. I was working very closely on the Bay of Pigs program.
Right. During that time, did you happen to notice any, clues or evidence that our president, George Bush, might have been involved in the Bay of Pigs operation also?
Well, to put it in a timely basis, in 1960 or 61, you know, we wouldn't have noticed that, because at that time, although earlier in my career I had been a professor at Yale University, at the same time that George Bush was a student there, the only way I would have known George Bush at Yale was that he was captain of the baseball team, and I don't remember as an individual, but we were that close. We were at Yale together in the late 40s. But during the Bay of Pigs period, no. But as I look back at it from now, there is one coincidence that probably is worthwhile calling to your attention. And that is that when I was asked to go to a source and get some ships that could be used to bring supplies and equipment to Cuba, I got them through a Navy office that was doing similar work to mine. We put them down in North Carolina, and these old ships were repainted, and while they were being repainted, they painted new names on them so they would appear to be ordinary merchant ships. The name they painted on one of them was Houston. The name they painted on the other was Barbara, and the Bay of Pigs project was known as Zapata. Well, now, I only know from hindsight that Mr. Bush's oil company was Zapata and his wife Barbara, and he lived in Houston. It's quite a coincidence, but
quite,
of course,
yes, quite.
In that period, we never even gave it a thought.
Right. I wonder if it's a coincidence that his son Jeb has a similar position down in Miami now, controlling the Cuban community down there.
Well, again, this business of, you use the word controlling the Cuban community, there were different layers of that, and it would take a long time to explain that. The Bay of Pigs program was approved by Eisenhower as a means of taking some of the skilled Cuban exiles and putting them into a military-type force to be used for occasional targeting. We dropped them by air. We brought them in by ship and put them over the beach. And Eisenhower, the leader of the greatest invasion that ever that was ever held, the invasion of Normandy, would be the last man to approve the invasion of Cuba by 1,200 men. That's no way. And Eisenhower did not approve an invasion. They left that at the election of Kennedy. And Kennedy finally made that decision on about April 16th of 61.
Okay. I wonder if another interesting coincidence is this man, Felix Rodriguez, who during the Iran-Contra hearings kept maintaining that George Bush was a close personal friend of his. And Felix Rodriguez was also one of the people involved in the invasion of Cuba. And according to Rodriguez, he became acquainted with George Bush during this period.
That is an area that is completely out of my work. I was a military officer. I was providing support as requested by the agency and approved by the White House. And my work was all done, with certain exceptions, in the Pentagon. I went to Panama one time and set up a base for the troops down there at Fort Gulak. And I went into Texas and Florida bases. But that was all done to set up the bases. I didn't meet the people, and on purpose I didn't meet the people. In clandestine operations, you cellularize your work very specifically. And I don't know Rodriguez or the rest of them. That was not in my business.
Right. No, I was just mentioning that it's an interesting coincidence that George Bush knows Felix Rodriguez, one of the main participants in the invasion of Cuba, mm-hmm. and also one of the leaders of the Contra effort in against Nicaragua. I thought that was an amazing coincidence.
You say that he was a leader in this invasion of Cuba?
Right. That's what the history books show, that Felix Rodriguez was
one of... Yeah, well, see, now, this was my point when we started, Paul. There are an awful lot of very bad history books about the Kennedy period, because the people who did not like Kennedy, the people who killed him, and I mean what I say, also have seen to it that the history books write about Kennedy in a very, very damaging way, and the man is dead, he can't answer for himself.
Right.
So there's no Rodriguez in the Kennedy program. I'm quite aware of the people that were in the Kennedy program. In the Bay of Pigs program.
Uh-huh.
The leaders, anyway. I didn't know all 1,200 men, but I knew the leaders.
Right, yeah, he was one of the 1,200.
Yeah, well, he could have been.
And then, have you heard of, there was a newspaper story out here last week of some sort of operation going on around Cuba on December 7th. The story came out of Miami that the CIA had rented a luxury liner and was going to be, they wouldn't disclose where they were going with it, but they were just going to the Pentagon. It was just going to be
December 7th, 1960?
December 7th, 1991. We're doing this program on the 2nd of December, and the story's been in the newspapers out here. And there were hints in the news story that the U.S. is planning an invasion of Cuba on December 7th. I just thought you might be aware of that.
Well, that's news. I'm not aware of it.
I should have mentioned it before the program. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then there was... Anyhow, so let's touch back on your knowledge of the period and the people you think might have... or the reasons why, I suppose, more important to understand why Kennedy was killed and his connection to the Bay of Pigs.
You see, one of the things that I think most people have heard, and it is not true, was that Kennedy denied air cover for the brigade on the beach when they needed it. Now, Kennedy had spoken over the radio about 2 weeks before the Bay of Pigs, telling the world that American troops would not be used in Cuba for any purpose. Now, there's a reason for that. During the Eisenhower administration, a very important National Security Council document had been passed and had been issued called 5412, NSC 5412, which absolutely prohibited the use of active duty American personnel, American military personnel, in covert operations, and then went on to define covert operations. And it is still the best definition and a very legal definition of covert operations, and it applied them to the CIA with the support of the military, in the sense that the military would provide guns and airplanes, submarines, and the rest. Kennedy, who had been in Congress then and knew that regulation very well, knew that it was impossible for the President of the United States to use active duty military personnel in support of a clandestine operation.
Ah, I
instead
see.
Instead of it.
I see the distinction.
And this is why he did not do it, and furthermore, it was not a plan of the Bay of Pigs operation at all. It did not even fit in with the plan. It was a very good plan for the Bay of Pigs operation, but it was interfered with and broken before they could land on the beach.
I see. When I was in the military, they called it Operation Vertical Envelopment. I don't know if you heard of that, but I was being trained in Maryland for part of the invasion, and I was supposed to be going in with the Marines to bring helicopters into the beaches.
Uh-huh.
That's what I was being trained for, and all I knew about is what we called it was Operation Vertical Envelopment.
Well, that's a term applied to paratroop use generally, but, and are you talking about 1962 or 1961?
Two. It was the, I think they were planning,
okay.
The second invasion was...
1962 was not a clandestine exercise. 1962 was an attempt by our government to deter the Cubans and Khrushchev, the Russians, from putting rockets and missiles in place in Cuba. That was a completely military activity headed by Strike Command at Tampa under General Paul Adams, and it was all military, and it was not CIA. That's the distinction between the two.
Uh-huh. But then there was that other one that Robert Kennedy uncovered in New Orleans. They were planning a secret invasion from New Orleans, and he sent the FBI down there to close down that base north of the lake.
That's a good one to have you bring up. There were certain Cubans, a lot of Cubans, who were politically unacceptable to the Frente, to the leaders of the Cuban exile group that had been selected by Howard Hunt, among others, by his boss, Dick Bissell, in the CIA, and they did not want those men involved in the Bay of Pigs operation. So rather than tell them that they were not going to go, they put them at a camp at Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, in Louisiana, and the other men were trained at the Trax base down at Guatemala. And at the base at Guatemala, they were training the true invasion brigade that was led by Manuel Artima, who, by the way, Kennedy knew very well. And they left from a base called Puerto Cabezas in Nicaragua for the invasion. The men in Louisiana were put on board ship, but their ships never even went near Cuba. They just kept them out on the water because they were not acceptable politically to the rest of the exile group.
Uh-huh.
They never would have landed on the beach.
Uh-huh. Okay. Could we go back to that 62 invasion for a minute? Were you in contact with that invasion also?
Very closely.
Uh-huh. And that was the attempt. Yeah, I remember my assignment was they gave me a huge map of Cuba on plexiglass.
Uh-huh.
And it was covered with canvas. Nobody was allowed to look at it. I was to keep track of the submarine net around Cuba in case one of our planes went down. And I was just wondering, what was your vision of what did you see of your portion of the...
Well, by that time, 1962, I was working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Lemnitzer. During that period, he sent me to Tampa with certain information for General Adams, who was head of Strike Command. And, of course, I don't know whether you went to Tampa or not, but Tampa, the... Air Base, MacDill Air Base there, was absolutely deluged with military men and more trucks coming in all the time and more planes coming in all the time, because if the President had given the go-ahead, there would have been an enormous invasion of Cuba from Tampa, Florida, and other bases. There were, the Navy was all set at Norfolk. I went over to Norfolk later. But, of course, at the last minute, there was an agreement between Khrushchev and Kennedy, and they did not invade. But it was a huge force. It had no similarity whatsoever to the small force that was the Bay of Pigs.
Right, yeah. I was stationed at the time at Patuxent River, Maryland. I don't think it's a violation of any security for me to talk about it nowadays, but they were training us in frogman techniques and in beach invasion techniques. And
almost the whole East Coast, as you're pointing out, Paul, Patuxent, Norfolk, on down through Florida, were activated for this thing, and it would have been an enormous invasion if it had come about.
Okay. Yeah, it just gets me back to that story that appeared out here about the December 7th. There's supposed to be some sort of, who knows what, go on out there. But I'm just curious what will happen in 5 days, actually before this tape is played. And I guess the only thing to do is just watch close. And from your background, I guess it'd be possible to call up people
well,
at Tampa.
Well, with President Bush's record at Panama and Iraq, and President Reagan's record in Libya and Grenada, who knows? This type of invasion or attack is apt to be what we might call warfare of the future, so-called surgical strikes, and of course we have the power to overwhelm Cuba or any other country on Earth right now, so
right.
It could happen.
Right. From your historical perspective, what would you say were the three main reasons that the CIA engaged in its treasonous act of killing Kennedy?
Well, your question is one I wouldn't place because you are putting it definitely on the shoulders of CIA, and I don't hold to that opinion.
Oh, okay. Well, what is your view on why he was killed and who did it?
I think that even beginning in the period of the Bay of Pigs, when Kennedy saw that he could not rely on the CIA for an operation as important as that was to him politically early in his campaign, the very next day after the invasion, there was a big discussion of Vietnam, and he had to get into that project. At the same time, they were trying to work out the enormous funding project for the purchase of the TFX airplane, the most money ever spent by the Defense Department up to that time. All of these things had fallen into the lap of Kennedy, and Kennedy took action on all of them in ways that were much different than the Eisenhower administration or that Nixon might have done had he been elected, that immediately the opposition began to get very, very severe. Kennedy was doing things with big amounts of money in ways that the power centers in this country had never run into before, and they were frightened or they were concerned about Kennedy's power, his reelection in 64, about what they called the possibility of Kennedy dynasty. And when you have that kind of power in any country, you have a coup d'etat. And the killing of Kennedy was a coup d'etat. There's no reason to fool ourselves that one young man up in a window on a sixth floor or some old building is going to kill the president and then write all the stories about the cover stories and everything else for the next 25 years. It's impossible.
So
when there's a coup d'etat, everything is done according to a certain plan, and that's how Kennedy died.
So it's too narrow to say CIA. It's a much broader military-industrial complex type of coup.
Well, CIA's been the fall guy for it and other things because the cover story depends on the CIA. The cover story depends upon Oswald, depends upon the Cubans, depends upon all the stories we hear in New Orleans about Clay Shaw and all the rest of it, the Jack Ruby angle. That's all cover story. We should understand that. That is all cover story. The real thing took place with a small team of hitmen, and it is President Lyndon Johnson who said this. Lyndon Johnson, in the July 1973 Atlantic Monthly said to the author, Leo Janus, that Oswald did not do it alone, that there was a conspiracy, and most important, he said, we have a murder incorporated. A murder incorporated, he's not talking about mafia, is an elite group of people who are highly trained and highly skilled and supported with everything they need to carry out a murder and to escape, because no policeman will ever touch them, and they go until they're called again.
Right.
That's the way these things are done, and Johnson said that himself just before he died.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing. Let me ask you a question about Kennedy's order to withdraw troops from Vietnam. Do you think that was also one of the motivating reasons for the coup?
Well, I have already touched on that, all of these things began to build up. And by the summer and early fall of 1963, it had become clear that Kennedy was going to withdraw all Americans from Vietnam. On October 2nd of 1963, he published a document which was called a National Security Action Memorandum, number 263. That's a White House document, as high as they go, and that document was the work of months and months of study. It was not a casual thing somebody wrote one afternoon. And that thing said, among other things, that 1,000 troops of the 16,000 that were in Vietnam then would be brought home by Christmas, and that by the end of 65, all Americans, it said all Americans, didn't say all military or something like that, it said all Americans will be out of Vietnam. Now, the reason for the bracketing of 63 to 65 is the election of 64, when Kennedy knew by then that he would be reelected easily on a campaign to get us out of Vietnam. This was his main campaign plank for 64, and this is another of those major reasons which caused his death.
Yes. Do you think that the drug traffic coming out of the Golden Triangle area there, the people that were smuggling the drugs out of there, were connected to the military-industrial complex people involved in the coup? Would that, in other words, would cutting, if we withdrew the troops, that would have cut off the heroin supply from that area, and a lot of people would have lost a lot of money?
Well, it's an interesting point, but just consider today, drugs are flowing into this country at a greater amount than ever before, and they come from many places. But there's an important point about when you talk about Southeast Asia and the Golden Triangle. I don't know whether you've heard this or not before, but when we had American troops in Burma and Chinese troops fighting with the Americans during World War II, forcing the Japanese back out of Burma and into Southeast Asia and eventually into surrender, the American finance officers, the American Army finance officers, paid the Chinese divisions with opium. That was the method of paying Asian armies at that time, and the U.S. Army had a supply of opium, and which they continued to have, and right on up to the Vietnam War. They knew where it came from. But it was, you might say, lawfully condoned in 1944-45, when we were fighting in Burma, that the Army finance officers would pay all those thousands and thousands of Chinese with opium. There was a source of supply, and that source of supply never dried up. And remember, they were fighting in Burma. That's the Golden Triangle.
So that we can actually, Americans' history of the drugs that are sweeping through our society now can be traced back to that period, then, directly.
Well, rather than take up an awful lot of time tonight, there's a marvelous book on the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia by Al McCoy, and I recommend anybody to read it, because it goes through these earlier days, and that doesn't mean that the drug problem was any less than now, but it shows that the drug problem that we are facing today had its antecedents in World War II.
Right, yeah. Well, Fletcher Prouty, should I say Colonel Fletcher Prouty, retired?
That's correct.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this Oliver Stone movie that's coming out. I think a lot of the material that we just covered will come up in the movie, and at least it will ignite the discussion again in this country, the discussion we should have had in 64.
Well, Paul, you're right. There will be no more important movie in these years, not just one year, but in these years, than this movie that Oliver Stone and his team have just put together, and that opens on December 20th. People are going to hear things that are believable that they haven't heard before.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that was Colonel Fletcher Prouty speaking to us from the East Coast on the role of the history of the Kennedy assassination as he understands it, as he saw it, as he lived it. It's important that people understand why the media is attacking the Oliver Stone movie that is coming out now. And for instance, somebody just stuck a copy of a Chronicle article in front of me entitled, "In JFK's Oliver Stone, Stone Trashes the Truth." It's by a CIA journalist named Tom Bethel, who's joining the chorus of other CIA journalists attacking Oliver Stone for writing a movie, producing a movie that dares to point the finger at the military-industrial complex. Let's see. If people are interested in some of the documentation that Fletcher Prouty and I were talking about, I'll be glad to send it to you. Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope to P.O. Box 422-644, San Francisco, 94142. And let's take a musical break while you go get a pencil, and I'll give you that address again.
Missiles, the bombs and planes, we're off to war in the Christian way, and they're doing it in your name.
Okay, that address again was P.O. Box 422-644, San Francisco, 94142. And if you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, I'll send you the materials that will help you to understand this movie, because the media will not give you a straight view on the movie. And it's in, as Fletcher Prouty mentioned, it's probably the most important movie that's come out in the United States in the last 30 years. I said that. In fact, the opinions expressed on this program, Reality Sandwich, are those of myself and my guests. My name is Paul Kangas, and this has been Reality Sandwich, which is a weekly program examining a book by Judge Jim Garrison called On the Trail of the Assassins. And for some reason, it's hard to find that book in this country, but you can get it at Marcus Books at Fillmore and Geary in San Francisco, or you can get it at Forrester Books at 16th and Valencia over in that area. Thank you once again. This has been Paul Kangas, your host.
I stand and fight, but not alone. The people just don't want to know. I'll ease the pain and ease my mind and lose it all in red white wine.
Excuse me, Sonny. Do you happen to know what the defense budget was for 1982?
$700 million a day. Excuse me, but I got to go.
I'd like to call my daughter Doris along.
Yeah.
You happen to know what time it is in Tanzania?
12 hours later than it is here. That woman is crazy. I'll see you later, ma'am.
It seems like you already know where we're back there we are.
What good is knowledge or the facts?
If you know, then you must act when the armies are...
Weapons, banks, and land. Call us Armageddon Man. want more, so we take it from the poor. You can't stop us, no one can, because we're Armageddon Man. Karl Marx predicted our demise, but it's on crisis that we thrive. They'll find a new market, or a war will do, and we'll see our historic mission.
Isn't that great music? Isn't that incredible? That's the San Francisco Mime Troupe with their Armageddon Man. Thank you to the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Prophetic theater at its best right here in America, 1984. Whoops, it's 1991. Why am I flashing back to 1984? Probably because I just saw the movie by Oliver Stone titled JFK. And a brilliant, beautiful movie. If you haven't seen it yet, please go out and see that movie. It is the best movie, the most important movie that's been made in the United States in 30 years. It's the movie that the CIA and George Bush told Oliver Stone couldn't be made. But Stone refused to buckle under. I guess if you've been a vet in Vietnam and you faced death over there, you come back here and you have some clown CIA agent like George Bush threatening you, doesn't mean too much anymore. Besides, the country is waking up to the fact that George Bush committed treason, not only with his October surprise, but his involvement in the assassination of John Kennedy, which we can now prove through FBI documents. And if you would like information on that, please contact me. I'll give you the address in a minute. This is Paul Kangas, and this program is Reality Sandwich. It's a look at the black and white, crazy 1984 world of 1991. And something's happening in America right now with this Stone movie, other than the media is going ape attacking it and telling you don't go see it. It seems as though Americans are waking up and trying to get all the homework done that wasn't taken care of before we enter the millennium of the year 2000. So people are looking back to 1963 and saying, we made a mistake, you know, when the CIA and the military-industrial complex assassinated Kennedy, we didn't rise up. And now there's an upwelling happening in the United States, a huge upwelling, a ripeness, as we prepare to enter the year 2000 with this long-range perspective. So one of the things that usually happens on this program every Tuesday morning is I read a short section of the book On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison. I started doing the program when I discovered the book was banned in the U.S., and I thought, wow, they can't do that to a great book like this. And then Oliver Stone read it and decided, hey, this book is so great, it belongs on the silver screen. And so Stone's doing it, and in order to alert people to the beauty of this book, I thought I would show you a bit of it. Because remember, if John Kennedy had lived, the Vietnam War would not have happened. And Jim Garrison, much to his credit, did one of the few serious investigations into who killed Kennedy. Of course, the CIA journalists are all claiming that Jim Garrison did a weird investigation, that Jim Garrison did a reckless investigation because he dared to charge the CIA with the assassination of President Kennedy. And if you want to see, Woodward and Bernstein, who is it, Carl Bernstein, once wrote an article pointing out that the CIA maintains 400 of its agents working as the top journalists in the United States. And if you want to see these CIA journalists pop out of their holes right now, just take a look at all the journalists attacking Stone's movie, and you will know which are the CIA journalists. I'm sorry if you think that's a bit black and white, but if you don't use those kind of theories to examine what's being told to you, you can be lied to by the Central Intelligence Agency, which is the central news agency for the United States. If it isn't approved by the CIA, it can't be printed in the New York Times or the Chronicle. And by the way, if Kennedy had lived, to get back to what this program is about, if Kennedy had lived, the vast drug plague that is sweeping the United States, destroying the minds of our young people, destroying our cities, destroying our communities, would not have happened. If you've been listening to this program, you're aware of the book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. We fought, some people fought, the Vietnam War. Personally, they tried to send me to Vietnam. I said no. And they gave me 1 year of punishment duty for it, but I didn't realize at the time what was going on, but after now I realize I was right to refuse duty in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam was fought to maintain the heroin traffic coming from Vietnam, because Kennedy had given an order to cut off the troops in Vietnam. That was National Security Agency Memo 263 Kennedy issued, saying he was going to withdraw all Americans from Vietnam. He didn't say all military, because he knew the CIA are disguised as civilians, disguised as businessmen, disguised as journalists. And so Kennedy said all Americans will be out of Vietnam. And when Kennedy was running for re-election in 1963, his main plank on his platform was U.S. troops out of Vietnam, U.S. CIA out of Vietnam, U.S. out of Vietnam. That's what Kennedy was saying in 1963. Kennedy gave his life to try and save the 20 million Vietnamese and 58,000 Americans who died in that war fought to maintain heroin traffic into the United States. And we should place John Kennedy's name on the Vietnam War Memorial as the first person killed in the Vietnam War, because if Kennedy had not died, the Vietnam War would not have happened. If Kennedy had not died, the huge drug plague that is sweeping the United States into the dustbin of history would not have been brought into this country, smuggled into this country on the CIA airplanes, Air America. We now are reaping the fruits of the assassination of John Kennedy. If you walk through our inner city ghettos and see what the war delivered to us, strange fruits, very strange fruits indeed. Okay, now let me read a short section of Jim Garrison's book right after this musical break.
We're number one. We'll win the war that can't be won. You won't survive it. No one can. Thanks to Armageddon Band. Thanks to Armageddon Band. Thanks to Armageddon Band.
Yes, and okay. Here's quoting Jim Garrison. Precisely how many shots were fired, from precisely where, and by whom, are questions that still remain unanswered in America in 1991. But one thing I am quite sure is that Lee Harvey Oswald did not fire at anyone on November 22, 1963. His negative nitrate test, his abysmal marksmanship record in the Marines, his generally unaggressive personality, and the poor quality of the rifle he allegedly bought through the mail and allegedly used, and the lack of any evidence of his involvement in the Tippit murder, all confirm that he killed no one and that he was, as he claimed, a patsy. The president's blood had hardly cooled before the well-organized cover-up began. The hijacking of his body in an ambulance to Air Force One over the vociferous objections of Texas officials at Parkland Hospital, allowed the body's quick removal before the required local autopsy could reveal that he had been hit from both the front and the back. Lyndon Johnson was promptly sworn in as the new president to head off the alarming possibility of a national security emergency. Then the plane made its getaway from Love Field and headed for the military autopsy waiting at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, where they could cover up all the evidence of an assassination. There, the Hippocratic Oath and any serious search for the truth would suddenly be swept away in the face of the first rule of the military, to obey orders without question. Don't worry about the truth. Obey orders. Once Air Force One took off and Kennedy's body was airborne, it could finally be announced officially that the president had been shot only from behind. It could be announced that a lone assassin, a disoriented young Marine drifter with no motive and no supporters, had done it all, and that the Dallas police already had him under arrest in the office of the captain. The feared emergency was over. The United States government was in good hands, and public opinion was under control. The coup d'etat had accomplished its objectives with clockwork precision. The life had been ripped from the chief executive of the United States government, and major changes in American foreign policy would be arriving not in months or weeks, but in the next several days. In fact, the next day, Johnson ordered a re-invasion of Vietnam. Now, there's one thing Garrison doesn't point out. The killing of John Kennedy so terrorized the politicians in the U.S. government that people like Barbara Boxer dare not speak out. No elected official will dare speak up about this. And if Barbara Boxer, if you're listening, please remember, or if any of you listening know the phone number to Barbara Boxer's office, call her up. Ask her her opinion of the movie JFK. Ask her her opinion of the coup d'etat that happened in the United States. Ask her to take a position on the treason that was committed in 1963. But she's afraid to. She's afraid for her life. Not justifiably either. There is no reason to fear the CIA anymore. The CIA is just smoke and mirrors, and the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. What we have to do instead of fearing the CIA is to speak up against the CIA, expose them, and put them in jail for what they did. George Bush was directly involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. For that reason, he must be arrested and placed on trial. Richard Nixon was directly involved. Richard Nixon must be arrested and placed on trial for the treason they committed against us. And it isn't only us that they murdered. The Vietnamese and the young kids in our communities who are suffering under this terrible drug plague. That's my opinion. And as long as I'm allowed to speak my opinion, I'll speak it. Okay, back to Jim Garrison's great book. Meanwhile, the cover-up was progressing. The Secret Service sent Governor John Connally's clothing, along with all the evidence it contained, to be laundered, and then proceeded to scrub down the president's limousine, again washing away crucial traces of blood, bone, bullets, and evidence. And by the way, I'm reading from Chapter 20, Garrison's book, On the Trail of the Assassins, and you can get it at Marcus Brooks, Geary, and Fillmore and Geary. Later, the agents of the Secret Service would investigate Lee Harvey Oswald's office in Guy Bannister's operation and fail to find anything remotely suspicious. The FBI hushed up the fact that it had been informed of a plot to kill a president 5 days before the actual assassination and began bullying witnesses like Fennell Farrington and trying to silence other witnesses like Richard Randolph. It went so far as to alter the statements of the eyewitness Julianne Mercer, who identified Jack Ruby as the man she had seen dropping off a rifleman at the grassy knoll an hour before the assassination in broad daylight. The Dallas Homicide Unit managed to lose two rifles found in the Texas School Book Depository. One of them, the highly accurate 7.65 Mauser. And the police never bothered to check out Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig's report that he had seen a Nash Rambler station wagon carrying four men, three of them Cubans, including a white male that resembled Oswald, leave from in front of the depository, and even denied hearing of such a thing, in spite of the fact that there are tape recordings on the police radios to that effect. And it concealed for 10 months Oswald's negative nitrate test. A comment here. Most of you listening probably know that a nitrate test is what the police give to determine if somebody has fired a gun in the last 48 hours. Oswald was given a nitrate test, which showed that he had not fired a gun in the last 48 hours. He was given it 3 hours after the assassination of John Kennedy. More positive, direct evidence that Oswald had nothing to do with the assassination of John Kennedy. And anybody that tries to tell you different is just trying to blow smoke in your ear. And then we have the case of Jack Ruby. The FBI concealed that Jack Ruby was an employee of Richard Nixon's. If you would like evidence of that, by the way, please send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I will send you the FBI memo showing that Jack Ruby was an employee of Richard Nixon's and has been since 1947, a hired hitman working for Richard Nixon to suppress the enemies of Richard Nixon. Isn't that an interesting coincidence? To continue with Garrison. With the cover-up such a stunning success, the stage was now set for the ratification of the assassination. The surviving elements of the new government, from Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, and Earl Warren on down, were quick to see the advantages of supporting the scenario that no coup d'etat had occurred and that our democracy was safely intact, that a lone malcontent had murdered the president in a meaningless, random act of violence. And they were quick to understand the message of those who had engineered the assassination, that there was a forceful consensus that wanted the Cold War to resume at its pre-Kennedy intensity. There is no evidence that Johnson, Hoover, Nixon, George Bush, Warren, or Allen Dulles had any prior knowledge, but I would not hesitate to classify all these men as accessories after the fact. Well, that's what Garrison says, but the evidence shows that Allen Dulles planned it. Okay, so that's what you'll see in the movie. As soon as the non-participating elements in the intelligence community saw that a coup d'etat had occurred, they moved quickly to support the official story. Motivated in some instances by self-preservation and in others by a belief that Kennedy had brought about the assassination on himself by compromising too often with the Soviets, the remainder of the government, from high elected officials to heads of departments and agencies, and by the way, the media. By the way, did you ever notice that the word media is spelled M-E-D-I-A? Just a joke there. Joke. It's a CIA joke. This is the way of all successful coup d'etats. In the early 17th century, Sir John Harrington, the English poet, described in a few lines a coup d'etat as he saw it in his period. Quote, "Treason doth never prosper. What's the reason? For if it prosper, none dare call it treason." The beginning of the formal ratification process came when Congress allowed President Johnson, the heir to the power, to appoint the Warren Commission, including ex-CIA agent Director Dulles, who had been fired by Kennedy, to investigate the murder of Kennedy. The commission's report, carrying the prestige and credibility of its highly respected chair, put the official government stamp of approval on the lone assassination fairy tale. For the government, reluctance to face the pre-assassination involvement of the CIA and the participation of its other intelligence agencies in the cover-up, such a ratification must have seemed the easy way out. For many years afterwards, federal officials did their best to prop up this crumbling edifice as critics tore it apart, leaving almost no one still believing in the lone assassination scenario, except ABC, CBS, and NBC still spread that fairy tale in an attempt cover up. with the murder plainly unsolved, accusations of presidents and attorney generals, each with the resources of the FBI and the entire federal government at their command, made no effort to get to the truth. On the contrary, when I, Jim Garrison, attempted a real investigation of the assassination, federal officials sought to suppress the truth. I received no cooperation, and when I sought to subpoena key witnesses like Alan Dulles, I found critical federal records destroyed, altered, and classified as secret or sealed by the federal government for 75 years to stop an investigation into who killed the president. I found myself denounced by the President Johnson, denounced by the Attorney General, and even the Chief Justice, a strong supporter of Richard Nixon. I found my investigation infiltrated and subverted by federal agents. And ultimately, I found myself on trial in a trumped-up federal case. That is what happens when you try, when you do not go along with the new government's ratification of the coup d'etat of 1963. And by the way, Garrison mentions that his investigation was infiltrated by FBI agents. In the Chronicle on 12/3/91, one of these undercover agents, Tom Bethel, discusses his infiltration of Garrison's investigation. And it's cute to see these FBI agents and CIA agents pretending to be journalists in the various newspapers. Now, it's time for a short musical break in order to help you to enjoy this program more. It's supposed to be relaxing. After all, this is 1991, and it's a time to lay back and relax. Think about the future as we enter the year 2000. To the library and look up a lot of this history. But now let's talk about sex. It seems that some of the people in the Kennedy family have participated in various sexual activities over the years, or at least that's alleged. I'm not sure I believe the stories about John Kennedy sleeping with Marilyn Monroe and Bob Kennedy sleeping with Marilyn Monroe. And some people even claim that all three of them were in one bed at the same time. But philosophically, if you think about that, people who make love have less of a tendency to make war. So maybe what we should do is propose to George Bush and Dan Quayle that they talk to Madonna, the heir apparent to Marilyn Monroe. Just a joke. But seriously, and if you believe that John Kennedy may have slept with Marilyn Monroe, what does that mean? That means that all studies in this area indicated that people who don't engage in sexual activity have developed pent-up energies that get misdirected into violence. So, when somebody tells you, in an attempt to smut the image of John Kennedy, that why should we worry who killed John Kennedy? Why, he slept with Marilyn Monroe. And when he was married, that's, you know, not being Catholic, that doesn't offend me, but you should turn to that person and point out that that may have been a naughty, naughty thing for John to do, or was it Marilyn soliciting him? I'm not sure. A naughty thing for Marilyn to do, but hey, he didn't kill anybody. You know, he didn't murder 20 million Vietnamese. In fact, John Kennedy tried to stop the war in Vietnam. And if Kennedy had lived, the war would not have happened. But that's, you know, that's the point. People stop me, and occasionally when I'm speaking at college campuses, and they say, you know, I don't understand that. Here, John Kennedy was sleeping with Marilyn Monroe, and why don't you talk about that? I don't talk about it because the smut papers usually talk about that. That's a philosophical point that I thought was important to be raised. Now let me go through a few other points that you might want to know about in the history of this stuff, because probably by now you've seen the movie, and you're wondering exactly what to do, because newspapers and television stations are all saying, don't see the movie. Well, there's things you can do. Get involved, write to us at P.O. Box 422-644, and we'll send you information on what you can do to get involved. See, the election's coming up in 1992, and George Bush is running. And if it's true that George Bush was involved in the invasion of Cuba, and yet he denies it, why does George Bush deny his involvement in the invasion of Cuba? And we can prove it. Here's 5 points to ponder about it. We have an FBI document that shows he was involved in the invasion of Cuba. He denies it. The Nation magazine tracked the story down and proved that George Bush was involved in the invasion of Cuba. But for some reason, Bush still denies that he was involved. His son, Jeb Bush, now holds the same role in Miami, attempting to supervise and control the Cubans in Miami to keep them from talking too much about their role in the assassination of John Kennedy. Because if you read Garrison's book, and I recommend it, you will notice in there numerous references to eyewitnesses, many eyewitnesses, for instance, prisoners at the jail across from Beasley Plaza. Numerous prisoners were looking out their cell windows through the bars and saw the president assassinated. They also saw various Cubans with rifles on top of the police department shooting at the president. Isn't that amazing? Well, those kind of things are in the important things that you will get out of seeing this movie and reading the book. And then you can use that information to question Bush's role in the assassination during the campaign in 1992. Okay, this has been Reality Sandwich with your host, Paul Kangas, a review of important information on the Kennedy assassination. And thank you for listening.
The power that is mine to give, it's up to you to stop Armageddon Man.
It's the breath of life, they want to smother, so fight for life, the earth your mother, fight for your sister and your brother. If we lose this fight, there won't be a